Numbers 11:4 through chapter 12, the second talk in a series on the narrative portions of Numbers, was presented by David Crabtree on October 31, 2004, at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2004. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction, all other rights reserved.
We'll be looking at Numbers, chapters 11 and chapter 12 today. I'm going to be teaching for the next few weeks in Numbers. I'm working my way through the narrative portions, the historical narrative portion of Numbers. I'm avoiding the legislation. So that's why last week we jumped into the middle of chapter 10 of Numbers, and that's where we'll be. I'll be continuing on from that part. The section from the middle of chapter 10 until the end of chapter 12 is all this one leg of their journey. It's from Sinai to the doorstep of the Promised Land. And the way that it is laid out by Moses, it resembles the description of the leg of the trip from Egypt to Sinai. Because in both cases, we have three instances of complaints on the part of the Israelites, and also some kind of interaction with one of Moses' in-laws regarding that in-law in leadership of some kind. I am just now becoming aware that the Old Testament narratives seem to be arranged in very definite patterns of events, that the author has arranged them in such a way that it forms a pattern. And let me give just in this instance, let me point that out. On the trip from Egypt to Sinai, there are the three complaints followed with the interaction with the father-in-law. Then they're at Sinai for a period of time. Then before they leave Sinai, there's an interaction with an in-law, and then the three complaints. So it's in mirror image. I'm not sure what to make of that. There are a lot of those kinds of patterns that are discernible in the Old Testament narratives. In a Jewish commentary that I consult, it's just full of observations of those patterns. There's a recent commentary by Bruce Waltke on Genesis where he spends the whole commentary pointing out those kinds of patterns. And it's interesting, but I don't know what to make of those patterns. Sometimes it appears to me that it is very intentional. Other times it appears to me that it wouldn't necessarily be intentional. If I were to say, I went to my friend's house, I sat down, then I got up from sitting, and I left. Is that an intentional chiastic that is a mirror image pattern? And I would say, not necessarily. I mean, how else are you going to tell that story? So I'm not sure exactly what to do with these patterns, but I am now convinced that many of them are intentional. The author has built them in. In this particular case, I can see what he seems to be doing. And that is, he wants us to compare the account in Exodus, where they're moving from Egypt to Sinai, with this one in Numbers, where they're moving from Sinai to the Promised Land. Because the kind of interaction that God has with the people is significantly different in the two instances. And we'll talk about that more in just a minute. Okay, so last week we talked about his interaction with his brother-in-law. At least that's my understanding, is that that's probably the best understanding, is interpretation, is that's his brother-in-law that he's talking to. We talked about the first complaint, and then we started into the second complaint. And let me just refresh your memory on what the second complaint is. And then we want to look at how God relates to Moses in this situation, and then I want to talk about how God relates to the people of Israel. The second complaint is the people are saying, we have no meat. And as it goes on to elaborate a bit, it's that the people of Israel are saying, you know, we were better off in Israel. I'm sorry. We were better off in Egypt. There we had fish that we could catch. We could scavenge for onions and garlic and cucumbers and melons. And here, all we've got is this manna. So their complaint is not that they're starving, but they are bored with their fare. The food is not of optimal variety. Now, previously, whenever they had complaints, this is back in the first leg of the journey when they're going from Egypt to Sinai, in every instance, Moses listens to the complaints, is empathetic with the complaints. He's right there among them. He's experiencing the same problems. He's empathetic with the complaints, and he appeals to God for help. And he does that all three times in that first leg of the journey. On this leg of the journey, in this second complaint, Moses' response is very different. And there are three things that he says in response to these complaints that he's hearing from the Israelites. The first, he says, God, why am I burdened with these people? I didn't bring them into being. You're the one that brought them into being. They're your people, not my people. It's like the way my wife refers to our youngest when it's bedtime. He's mine. Your son. So Moses is saying, your people, they're your people. Why am I burdened with them? The second is, they want meat, and I cannot satisfy that need. I can't give them meat. Where would I get the meat? And so his third, the third component of his response is, let me die. A little melodramatic, maybe. But he wants out of this. Now, this is not a characteristic response on the part of Moses. If you look at the rest of the Pentateuch, it is difficult to find a situation in which Moses is so distraught, is so impatient with the people, and is so despairing of how this can be resolved, and asks that he might die. And I think God recognizes that. This is not characteristic. What's happened? Moses is exhausted. And in this moment of exhaustion, he can't cope with the situation that he's facing. So God's response is very merciful, it seems to me. First, he said his response, first of all, is he's going to provide help in leadership. And the second is he's going to provide meat miraculously. And as we read last time, then, he has Moses prepare for both of these things. He has Moses select 70 men from among the elders who can help him to provide leadership. And God says, bring them to the tent of meeting, and I will share your spirit with them. The second thing he tells Moses to do is to consecrate the people. And presumably what he means by that is the people are supposed to bathe themselves and wash their clothes in preparation of a confrontation with God. That to consecrate yourself is to prepare yourself for some kind of direct interaction with God. And God says, I will then provide meat for 30 days for all of the people. In fact, they will have so much meat that they will grow sick of it. Now, there's an interesting feature that I didn't talk about last time in this interaction between Moses and God. When God says that he's going to inflict this punishment on them, he says it's because you have rejected the Lord who is among you. So it's a rejection of God. We'll come back to that in a little bit. But who is among you? God is stressing the fact that he's right down here in the circumstances with them. Moses responds saying, there isn't enough meat out there. And I know how much meat is necessary because he says, the people among whom I am are 600,000 on foot. I think implicit in what Moses is saying is, look, I know the circumstances here. You, God, are divorced from this situation. I'm right down here in the middle of it. And there are too many people to provide meat for. So Moses has obviously lost all perspective. It's not like Moses to get things out of perspective and to start thinking that this situation is too difficult for God to handle, and to think that he, Moses, is the one that has to come up with the solution. Moses hasn't responded this way previously to situations. God is very gentle in his response then to Moses. He isn't condemning. He doesn't even point out some of the obvious, like, I'm the one that will do it, not you. His response is simply, and I like this in the Hebrew, is my arm too short? In other words, am I not up to the task? It's a rhetorical question with an obvious answer. So what God is going to do is to provide a miracle, perform a miracle that will provide the meat that is necessary to feed the people. And I think that miracle is as much for Moses as it is for the people of Israel. It's Moses that's lost perspective, and God is going to graciously just remind him of the truth. Next section then, Numbers 11, 24 and 25. So Moses went out and told the people the words of the Lord. Also he gathered 70 men of the elders of the people and stationed them around the tent. Then the Lord came down in the cloud and spoke to him. And he took the Spirit who was upon him and placed him upon the 70 elders. And it came about that when the Spirit rested upon them, they prophesied, but they did not do it again. So Moses goes out and he tells the people what God has told him. And presumably that includes not only his provision for extra leadership, but it also tells them about the meat that is going to come. And presumably not only that there's meat that's going to come, but there's going to be so much that they'll get sick of it. Presumably that's all a part of what he communicated to the people. Then he gathers the 70 men. He selects 70 and gathers them at the tent of meeting. God comes down in the cloud, and he speaks to them. And it says he took the Spirit who was upon him, that is Moses, and placed it upon the 70 elders. So God is taking of the Spirit that's on Moses and giving it to the 70 elders. Now, why is he doing that and what's going on? Is that a punishment of Moses? Is it taking away from what Moses has and distributing it to the 20? There's no indication that God is punishing here, so I don't think that we are supposed to see it that way. It's not like Moses has this finite quantity of which he's taking a portion and giving it to the 70. I think the image is more like a flame, in which Moses' spirit is like a flame that's burning, and he takes from that and he lights 70 other flames. So Moses hasn't lost anything, but rather the spirit has been distributed. Now, why does he take it from Moses and not just put his spirit upon the 70. I think God is being very careful here to indicate that Moses is still the main man. The authority that the 70 have is derived from Moses. They don't have independent authority. So they are in subservience then to Moses. Moses is still the leader of the people of Israel. Then it says that they prophesied. The word that is used here for to prophesy can mean to prophesy in the sense of to either predict or to just speak forth what God has to say. Or, in some instances, it refers to an ecstatic utterance. I don't know what's going on here, but whatever it is, it has to be a kind of prophecy that indicates that it works as a sign, that indicates that the Spirit has indeed been spread from Moses to them. So it has to be something that people look at and they say, that is indicative of them having the Spirit. So whether that's ecstatic utterance or whether it's something else, I don't know. But it's really serving as a sign. It happens once, and then it does not happen again. So the sign is given that indicates that they've received the Spirit, and that's enough. Next section, 26 through 30. But two men had remained in the camp. The name of one was Eldad, and the name of the other Medad. And the Spirit rested upon them. Now they were among those who had been registered, but had not gone out to the tent. And they prophesied in the camp. So a young man ran and told Moses and said, Eldad and Medad are prophesying in the camp. Then Joshua, the son of Nun, the attendant of Moses from his youth, answered and said, Moses, my Lord, restrain them. But Moses said to him, are you jealous for my sake? Would that all the Lord's people were prophets, that the Lord would put his spirit upon them. Then Moses returned to the camp, both he and the elders of Israel. This is an interesting exchange. We have two men who are not at the tent of meeting, but they begin to prophesy just like the ones that had been with Moses at the tent of meeting and had received of Moses' spirit. It says that they were among those who had been registered but had not gone out to the tent. It's not clear where they were registered. What is this registration? Well, there only seem to be two reasonable possibilities. One is registered in the sense of been a part of the census that it talks about earlier in Numbers. But that seems unlikely in this context because all of the people of Israel would have been registered in that sense. It seems more likely that Moses actually wrote down the names of the 70 men who were to receive the Spirit, the 70 men that were to share power. And for some reason, these two of the 70 did not go out to the tent of meeting. According to rabbinic tradition, they didn't go out because they felt inadequate. I don't know if that's the case or not, but there's some reason why they did not go out to the tent of meeting. In any case, the Spirit comes upon them, and the same sign that indicated that the 68 had received the Spirit, that same sign occurs with respect to these two. So a youngster apparently is a witness of them prophesying inside the camp, and he runs out to Moses and reports this to Moses. With Moses is his assistant, Joshua. Now, this is the same Joshua that later becomes very important in the conquest of the Promised Land. Joshua overhears this, and Joshua is a young man, became a servant to Moses and is apparently accompanying him and being an assistant to him throughout. Joshua hears this and he becomes alarmed. Why is he alarmed? I think it's because Joshua is looking at this through very human eyes. As an astute observer of human politics, he sees a potential problem here. Because there are two individuals who have received the Spirit, who have shown that God has touched them in a dramatic fashion. But it hasn't been obvious that the Spirit that they received came via Moses. As a result, they could make the claim that they received the Spirit independently. They are not subservient to Moses. And there would be the potential for them to raise up some kind of rebellion against Moses on the basis that they received the Spirit from God. I think that's what Joshua is concerned about. And as a result, his advice to Moses is, go arrest him. You've got to do something about this. There's a potential problem here. Moses' response is more in keeping with the Moses that we see elsewhere in the Pentateuch. Moses isn't worried. Moses' perspective is, I don't have to worry about these kinds of the potential political threat to my power. My power is not of my making. I am in this position because God put me here. And I will only leave this position when God removes me from here. And I'm content with all of that. And with that attitude, he's able to look at the situation very differently. These two are not a potential threat to him. But Moses is able to look at this and say, wouldn't that be wonderful if God's Spirit would rest on all of the people of Israel? I have to worry about a threat to my power. My concern is the same as God's concern, and that is that his people come to righteousness. And if God wants to spread his Spirit broadly, that's wonderful. It's not a threat to me. So Moses is able to be very gracious and unthreatened in a situation that, humanly speaking, could have been threatening. And this will become interesting later on as we get into chapter 12. Moses is not power hungry. Moses is not grasping for power and trying to keep it and control it and expand it. He's not worried about threats to his power. He's quite content with what God is going to do. Verses 31 to 35. Now there went forth a wind from the Lord, and it brought quail from the sea, and let them fall beside the camp, about a day's journey on this side and a day's journey on the other side, all around the camp, and about two cubits deep on the surface of the ground. And the people spent all day and all night and all the next day and gathered the quail. He who gathered least gathered 10 homers. And they spread them out for themselves all around the camp, while the meat was still between their teeth. Before it was chewed, the anger of the Lord was kindled against the people, and the Lord struck the people with a very severe plague. So the name of that place was called Kibroth Hattaavah, because there they buried the people who had been greedy. From Kibroth Hattaavah, the people set out for Hazeroth, and they remained at Hazeroth. Okay, the first thing that God did in response to the people's complaints and Moses' despair was to help Moses out and provide other leadership. And he did that by the spreading of his Spirit which in Hebrew is ruach. Now, this wind is sent from God, and the Hebrew word for wind is ruach. So in both cases, it's God's ruach that's at work. The wind blows the quail to this area in the Sinai. And this is apparently a phenomenon that occurred on a regular basis. And I think, if I'm remembering correctly, it's in the spring that this tends to happen, that migrating quail are blown by the strong winds to the Sinai and are worn out. And so they fall on the ground and can't fly for a while. And the people of that area would go out and collect them. So this is something that we know historically happened on a fairly regular basis. In this case, God has brought a lot of quail to this area. It says that they fall beside the camp a day's journey on this side and that side. So I don't know what a day's journey is, 10 miles or something, I would assume. Maybe it's less than that. But we're talking about a big area in which these quail have been blown by the winds and they're lying on the ground. And they're piled up deep, 2 cubits deep. And a cubit in various times in ancient history is slightly different lengths, but it's approximately the length of one's arm. So 2 cubits, that's a lot. So they're really piled up. Now, presumably, it's not 2 feet everywhere. That would be an awful lot of quail. And it would even be hard for them to get around. I mean, they didn't have quail plows back there. So I think we're talking about quail drifts of as much as two cubits. But apparently, in some areas, it piled up as much as that. And then we've got quail spread over this whole area. So we've got a lot of quail that are lying around, exhausted. So the people start picking them up. They pick them up all day long. They pick them up throughout the night and then the next day. So the people are eager to get this meat that God has miraculously provided. And then they lay the stuff out to dry. So apparently they're trying to preserve as much of it as they can. This is apparently the standard way of preserving meat in Egypt. When they would catch fish, they would lay it out to dry, and they're doing the same thing now with the quail. So they've got lots and lots of meat that they have gathered over a period of 36 hours. They've got it out, they've got it spread out over the ground to dry, to preserve it so they can have it for later. They've collected at the minimum 2 homers of quail, whatever that is. But it's a lot. Then a plague strikes. While they're still chewing the meat, while they've still got meat between their teeth, the plague strikes. Now, is there a relationship between the quail and the plague? Well, the timing is very coincidental, and it could be that they're getting sick from eating the quail. But the text does not make it clear that there is such a connection. It's possible that there's a connection, but I would find that, I think, a little bit troubling, that God would send this meat, but that the meat would be itself contaminated and be spreading the disease. I think I would find that a little bit troubling. But the text doesn't make the connection between the quail and the disease in any way other than just it happened simultaneously. In any case, a plague was sent. God did inflict the plague upon them, and we have a number of people dying. And those people who die are buried, and as a result, this place is called Graves of the greedy, I think, is the way that the name of it is translated. Yes, the graves of the greedy, of greediness. The graves of greediness. So this place becomes commemorated with that name, preserving the memory of this incident in which the people of Israel had greedy desires. Why did God punish them in this way? Well, first of all, there's a sense in which he gave them the very thing that they had wanted. Their complaint was, we don't have meat. All we have to eat is this manna, and we have nothing to break up the monotony. We want meat like we had in Egypt. And God gives them meat. And that is something that God does, it seems to me. He has certainly done it in my life, in which I have wanted something very badly, and to show me how inappropriate my desire was, God gave me the very thing that I wanted. Because in our desires, there's the tendency for us to romanticize this thing that we want, and this thing is perfect. And we blow it up and conceive of it in a way that's not realistic whatsoever. And when God gives us the real thing, we realize this is not living up to my expectations. Some of you have heard this story, but I'll tell it again. When I was in high school, I wanted a scuba tank. I wanted it very, very badly. I worked hard to earn the money so I could buy one. And one came on sale. I think it was at Penny's. I got Penny's Best. Came on sale, so I ran down with my money and bought it. And I came back home and was assembling it. I was putting the pack together with the tank and putting the regulator on and all that sort of thing. And I was just overcome with this feeling of nausea, because I had built this thing up into such an idealized thing that was going to make life wonderful. And I get it home and I am assembling it in our living room, and it's obvious it's going to fall far short of what my expectations had been. I think that this is a similar kind of thing that God is doing here, that they've built up what the food was like in Egypt to such an extent that it is far beyond what food can do. Food just can't provide that kind of fulfillment and happiness. And so he says, okay, I'll give you meat, all the quail you can eat and more. And they eat it until they're sick of it. If that's what God is doing, it's interesting that he doesn't give them exactly what they asked for. And it seems to me that that's a little problematic, because if I were an Israelite, I would say, yeah, I got quail, but what I wanted was fish, and I didn't get that. So there's still that opportunity for the romanticized notion to continue. And God has not dispelled that. Why is God so harsh in his punishment? There are people that die here because of this. Earlier, God was not so harsh in his punishment when the people were complaining, when we talk about that, the part from Egypt to Sinai. Now, all of a sudden, in the complaints that we see in Numbers, people are dying. In the first complaint, people died, and now in the second complaint, people are dying. Why the difference? I'm not sure, but there are a few differences of circumstances. When they were going from Egypt to Sinai, they had not yet had all that much experience with God. It is true that they had observed the plagues, and they had observed the miracle of them being allowed to pass through the Red Sea before Pharaoh's army. But that's all the experience that they had had. So it could be that that is a factor. Another thing, they had not received God's laws. They had not been made into God's people to the extent that they have after Sinai. The third thing is, in the first part, they were complaining about real needs. They were out of food. They were out of water. And God met those needs. Now, we don't know exactly what the specifics of the first complaint were, but the second complaint is, we're tired of the food that we're getting. I would say that's a qualitatively different kind of complaint. So now they've had more experience with God. They've received the law and have been made into God's people. And the complaints are less substantive. But what God says with respect to them is, they've rejected me. They've rejected my leadership. In essence, they preferred to be comfortable slaves in Egypt. In Egypt, they were slaves, but there was food there. Egypt was a blessed country. It was unique in the ancient world. Only in Egypt were there three harvests per year because of their climate and because of the opportunity to irrigate from the Nile. So even poor people in Egypt were well off because there was an abundance. God took them out of that situation, and he says, I promise you that I am taking you to a land flowing with milk and honey. But the problem is, they have to get from Egypt to this land. And that journey is a long and arduous one, and one in which there is an absence, there is a lack of food and water. So they've left comfortable slavery, and now they're just in very difficult circumstances. That on a day-by-day basis, life is hard. Well, what's to keep them going? Well, the thing that should keep them going is where they're going to. They're going to a land that's better than the one from which they left. And they will be free rather than slaves. But they have to accept that on faith. Because they aren't there yet. They've only heard about it. They haven't seen it. And that's what's difficult. They don't trust God. Given the option, they would rather be back in comfortable slavery. The question that they're faced with is, do we allow God to teach us to trust him so that the promise can sustain us? Or do we yearn to return to comfortable slavery? And how is it that God is teaching them to trust him? It's by just-in-time provision. It's just enough food for the day. So every day, they are having to think, will I have enough food tomorrow? And God is continually providing for them, but it's not in excess. It's not gourmet food. It's just enough, just in time. And in that situation, people do one of two things. They either grow in faith and come to trust that the manna will be there again tomorrow, or you become bitter towards God because he's stingy. And the people of Israel have grown bitter because God's stingy. As a result, this is not a small complaint. This is a big deal, not a little deal. And God is not gentle with them, and a number of them perish. Chapter 12, verses 1 through 3. Then Miriam and Aaron spoke against Moses because of the Cushite woman whom he had married, for he had married a Cushite woman. And they said, has the Lord indeed spoken only through Moses? Has he not spoken through us as well? and the Lord heard it. Miriam is the sister of Moses. Aaron is the brother of Moses. They come with a concern, and they address it to Moses. It says Miriam and Aaron, so Miriam is listed first, and the verb that is used is third person feminine singular. So it's she spoke, even though there are two of them, Miriam and Aaron, that are doing the speaking. So presumably it's Miriam who's the ringleader in this. She's the one for whom this is primarily a concern. And the concern is, it's because Moses is married to a Cushite woman. Now, it's not clear who this is. We know that he's married to a woman by the name of Zipporah. She is a Midianite. He married her while he was in the desert before he went back to lead the people out of Egypt. Now, Cush is usually that term. Most specifically refers to the land to the south of Egypt. So Ethiopia now is the land that would be referred to as Cush. Zipporah is not Cushite in that sense. But sometimes the term is used more loosely, and if it's used more loosely, it could include the Midianites. So it's possible that they're complaining about his marriage to Zipporah. The other possibility is that Moses got married again. According to some rabbinic traditions, Zipporah died and Moses married again. It's not clear which it is. If it is Zipporah, it's possible that she has just rejoined them when they were at Mount Sinai and had not been with them before, and therefore is just now becoming a concern. In any case, the complaint is you are married to a Cushite, and the implication is you are married to a non-Israelite. And that is a problem. But as they go on, they say, has the Lord indeed spoken only through Moses? Has he not spoken through us as well? The first complaint is not the real complaint. The first is just the occasion on which the real complaint comes forward. And in my experience, when there are differences of opinion, where someone's upset at another person, it's often the case that the occasion in which this conflict, this tension is disclosed, is not at the root of the problem. The root of the problem comes later. And I think that's even the people that are voicing their concerns don't always know what the root of the problem is. But the root of the problem seems to be a jealousy towards Moses. That is, why is it that Moses has this privileged status among the Israelites when we, Miriam and Aaron, have both prophesied. They have both been used of God. Why is it that Moses enjoys this special position within the people of Israel? And the Lord heard it. Let me read on. 4-8. And suddenly the Lord said to Moses and Aaron and to Miriam, you three come out to the tent of meeting. So the three of them came out. Then the Lord came down in a pillar of cloud and said, I shall speak with him in a dream. Not so with my servant Moses. He is faithful in all my household. With him I speak mouth to mouth, even openly and not in dark sayings. And he beholds the form of the Lord. Why then were you not afraid to speak against my servant, against Moses? So God responds. He has Miriam and Aaron come to the tent of meeting, which is the place where he likes to directly confront people. And he says to them, look, if there is a prophet among you, what I do is I speak to them in dreams and visions. But Moses is in a different category. I relate to him differently. He says, I speak to him mouth to mouth, even openly and not in dark sayings, and he beholds the form of the Lord. God has a kind of relationship with Moses and a way of communicating with Moses that is unique. It's not like your normal run-of-the-mill prophet. He relates to him more directly, more clearly, more openly. And Moses, he says, is faithful in all my household. What God is saying is, I chose to relate to Moses differently. And for you to challenge that, for you to say that there is some problem with Moses enjoying this privileged status, is to challenge me. Because I'm the one that chose to do that, you're second-guessing me. The rest of that chapter. So the anger of the Lord burned against them, and he departed. But when the cloud had withdrawn from over the tent, behold, Miriam was leprous, as white as snow. As Aaron turned towards Miriam, behold, she was leprous. Then Aaron said to Moses, O my Lord, I beg you, do not account this sin to us, in which we have acted foolishly, and in which we have sinned. Oh, do not let her be like one dead, whose flesh is half eaten away when he comes from his mother's womb. And Moses cried out to the Lord, saying, O God, heal her, I pray. But the Lord said to Moses, if her father had but spit in her face, would she not bear her shame for 7 days? Let her be shut up for 7 days outside the camp, and afterward she may be received again. So Miriam was shut up outside the tent for 7 days, and the people did not move on until Miriam was received again. Afterward, however, the people moved out from Harath and camped in the wilderness of Paran. So after speaking to them, God takes action. And the form of the action is Miriam is covered with leprosy. As God departs, it becomes apparent that she is white with leprosy. And Aaron looks at her, and he's aghast. I mean, this is a horrible thing that has happened. And Aaron then appeals to Moses and says, oh, please do something. Please intercede on her behalf. It was not a big deal. We acted foolishly. It's interesting. He's downplaying the degree to which this is wickedness. We acted foolishly. But he appeals to Moses to do something to cure her. Once again, Moses intercedes. That's what Moses has been doing on behalf of the people of Israel right along. And once again, he does it. He intercedes on Miriam's behalf and asks that God remove this. God's response is, I will remove it, but think about it. If a father were to show his displeasure towards his daughter and spit in her face, I guess it's a cultural thing. If a father were to do that, she would have to spend 7 days out of sight before she could be accepted back in. That's just if an earthly father does that to his daughter. Surely Miriam should be out of sight for 7 days. that's not too severe. And so Miriam is kept outside of the camp for 7 days, and then after 7 days she is cleared of the leprosy, is readmitted to the camp, and the Israelites move on. This is all a very curious passage, it seems to me. Moses is acting strangely, and God, it seems, is in some ways particularly harsh here. But on the other hand, the nature of the wrongs are not little wrongs, they are genuine wickedness. What Miriam and Aaron are complaining about is they don't like the way that God has distributed his gifts. He has put Moses in a position of preeminence. That's not fair. What about us? It wasn't until a couple of years ago when I was reading in Kierkegaard where he's actually talking about a slightly different thing. He's talking essentially about Christ. And he's talking about Christ as the stumbling block. And he says that accepting Christ as God in human form, who dies for our sins, that's a difficult thing. If you really think about it, if you put yourself in the shoes of another Jew at the time of Jesus, and you have this ordinary person walk up to you and say, I am the Messiah, come to save you from your sins, you say he's crazy. And what kind of God would deal with man's sin that way? That's absurd. And coming to terms with that is really critical in coming to faith, in becoming a Christian. Accepting the notion that God, the creator of the universe, can do things any way he wants to, even if it seems ridiculous to us or unfair to us, that's part of what it means to become a believer, to accept God for who he is. And Miriam and Aaron are going through this. They're having to face into the fact that God distributes his gifts differently. Some people are greatly gifted. Other people are very modestly gifted. Is that okay with you? This is an issue that I have thought about a lot. There are, in a lot of different spheres, I face into my own inadequacies. And there's the temptation to cry out to God, it's not fair. It's not right. It's not right that I should be so lacking in basic gifts. That's just not fair. But ultimately the question is it okay with me? And if God wants to do it that way, is that okay with me? And coming to the place where you can be satisfied with that is, I think, a lifelong chore. I mean, whether it's with the way we look, whether it's with our physical abilities, whether it's with our intellectual abilities, whether it's with our abilities as a parent, abilities as a spouse. I mean, you can go on and on. We are all variously gifted. And it doesn't matter what sphere you look at, there are people out there that are more gifted than you in that particular sphere. Is that okay with you? To say it's not okay with me is to question whether God has the right to rule the universe the way he chooses to do so. It's to say, I won't allow you to be the creator that you are. And that's a tough thing to swallow, but critical. And to not accept that is true wickedness. It is rebelliousness. So throughout these three instances in which there are complaints on the people of Israel, it's all a question of being content that's being dealt with here. How does one be content? How do we think about the world such that we can be content in conditions that are not conducive to content in difficult times of life? And it ultimately comes down to a matter of trusting that God is the God that he claims to be, that he is in control, and that he does indeed love us. And that however bizarre the way he's working out his purposes, he is doing that. He's working out his purposes, and everything is right on schedule. Okay, questions, comments?
First of all, David, thank you very much. I think we all need to hear, especially that last part that you said. That was great, right on. Thank you. I'm just curious about the tendency of Bible teachers and commentators when they come across what seems really clearly to be a miracle in Scripture, both the Old Testament and the New Testament. There's a tendency, at least among some teachers and commentators, to look for some natural phenomenon that resembles the miracle or is a smaller scale version of the miracle or in some other way is a natural explanation to some degree of the miracle. Mm-hmm. Now, if the commentator or teacher were denying the supernatural nature of the event, then that would certainly be a motivation to look for a natural cause. You aren't doing that. You recognized you called the miracle a miracle. Why would you even care that there was any sort of natural phenomenon that resembled the miracle? I mean, it doesn't really matter. It's still a miracle.
Right.
So why do people do that?
Well, it is my observation that, generally speaking, God works through normal means, that is, according to the laws of physics and chemistry. And that's really what I come to expect. And there are times when he uses natural phenomena in our lives in a way that is nevertheless an indication of his personal interaction with me and experience. You know, there have been what I would consider several miracles in my life. Are they things that never happen? No, they are things that have happened to other people. Are they things that break the laws of physics and chemistry? No, they don't. But what made them miraculous is because I was in a situation where I desperately needed God's help in one way or another. And at the very moment when I needed it most, God provided that very thing. So God had set up the situation and in such a way that I psychologically needed X desperately at the very time that God provided X. And it's miraculous in that it's not something that just doesn't ever happen, has never happened, but how could it have, what are the odds that God would orchestrate his history of the universe such that that thing would happen right when I needed it most? And it seems to me that that's the nature of a lot of miracles, that God's direct interaction with us through events to bring about his purposes. In this case, this is a phenomenon. The quail coming is apparently a phenomenon that's observable. There are two things that are remarkable about it that make it stand out. One is the quantity of quail is unprecedented, and the other is it was just at the time that they were complaining. So the way I envision it is, once again, God is acting through history and his manipulation of events and occurrences, and he times things in such a way that this phenomenon occurs in an unprecedented level at the very time when the Israelites need it. And I'm not hesitant to call that a miracle. I think that's exactly what it is, that God has made it obvious that he's reaching into history and doing his thing. But apparently he isn't violating history and physics and chemistry here.
Would you say that he never violates physics and chemistry? I mean the parting of the Red Sea, I don't think there's any way to naturally explain that as just an aberration of something that occurs naturally, for example. And throughout the Bible, I think there are things that are clearly, I mean, Miriam's leprosy seems to me to be a miracle.
Well, and the multiplying the loaves and the fishes. Could there possibly be a natural explanation for those, like the parting of the Red Sea? I know that there are people working on that. There are some Israeli scholars that have got the topography of the floor of the Red Sea, and they're working on, they've got these fans set up, blowing winds, and all kinds of things to try to recreate what happened. If they recreate that, would it destroy my belief that that was a miraculous occurrence? Absolutely not. Can God violate the laws of physics and chemistry? Certainly he can. He made them. He can violate them. Has he in history? I don't know. I mean, it could be that the laws of physics and chemistry are far more complicated than we see. So would I completely rule that out? No, I wouldn't rule that out. It's just the laws of chemistry and physics are essentially how God usually operates. Can he operate otherwise? Absolutely.
Thank you. Mm-hmm.
A couple things. It seems like the analogy of life for us really relates back to the Israelites in terms of we're wanting to get to this promised land and we're just having to deal with life as it goes on. Is that kind of something?
Absolutely.
You apply to? And the one thing I'm always kind of a little bit confused about, especially in the Old Testament, is ascribing emotions to God about his anger burned. Mm-hmm. And it seems to me there's got to be humor involved because it's like you're asked for meat and I'm just going to dump this stuff on you. How do you deal with having that emotional element applied to God?
Well, I don't have any trouble with that at all, really, because God is indeed a person. He's not an abstract force. We are really encouraged to understand. I mean, I think there's plenty of evidence in the Bible that he is not just an abstract force. He is a person, and he relates to us as person. And so ascribing emotions to him is appropriate in helping us to see him as a person. And I think what we're to see here is what they did he saw as very, very wicked and wrong. And to communicate that, the author is saying he burned with anger.
Thanks. David, you skipped 12:3, and I was just wondering if there was a reason.
Oh, I did, didn't I? Yes. No, the reason is I skipped it. Okay. Not, it wasn't conscious. No, that is a curious verse. The verse says that now Moses was the most humble man that ever lived. A curious thing for Moses to write, if Moses wrote Numbers. And if your question is how did that get there? Did Moses write that? I don't know, and I really am kind of rethinking how the Pentateuch came to be. It is historically ascribed to Moses, but there are some things in there that are rather curious if Moses is the one who wrote it. And this is one of those things that's rather curious if Moses is the one that wrote it. But I think it is possible that there was a kind of editorial process that was carried out on the Pentateuch at some later date that is nevertheless authoritative and maintains inspiration. And here it's helpful because it's pointing out that the charges that were leveled against Moses are really unfounded. He really is not lording it over people. He is not power hungry. He's not power grabbing. And the previous incidents really point that out. He had opportunity to be so, but he isn't that way. And this is just making obvious what was implicit in the previous section.
Thank you. Mm-hmm.
I think we need to let people go. Thanks.